Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM programme about design and transport. We're chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's C-A-T-C-H. It's the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful geeky subjects as myself and the guests who very kindly joining me. In this edition, one of Britain's most prolific lecturers and authors on railway architecture, the London Underground, and the relatively unresearched material culture of roads from the 1920s Stonehenge Cafe to the M6. Today we're joined by Dr. David Lawrence. Welcome to the Catchcast.
Hello, Mark. It's great to be here, and it's really lovely to be back on the island. It's been a long time away.
Oh, well, we're going to find out when you were here and what you got up to in a bit. So thanks for being here, David. And we'll also speak in detail about your excellent books, your love of motorway services, and even a dive into some pirate radio and holiday camps. But I wonder if we can start, David, by taking you right back to your upbringing and ask, how did you get so sort of fascinated by our transport heritage?
Well, it's a combination of London suburbs and the Isle of Wight, actually. When I was probably 10 or 11, I stopped being interested in fossils. And before I was interested in something new, I can remember the local station in southwest London, trains moving around, level crossing. There seemed to be something magical about the fact that you could walk over the railway tracks, you could see all these trains. And I used to go down and watch them just moving in and out of the platforms before I could actually afford to go anywhere on them. But they were something interesting to watch when I wasn't at home. And the family had a holiday on the island in 1973. And I can remember queuing up to get into the station at Haven Street. Very hot, sunny day. I was bored. It was the only day of the holiday that I was allowed to choose where to go. My sisters got to choose the other days. And we were queuing up, and this old lady turned around and said to me, "Do you like trains?" And I thought, who's this weird old lady? Why is she talking to me? She said, "Give me your address and I'll send you something." Went back home and thought nothing more of it. And about 6 weeks later, this envelope turned up, and inside was rather scented, I think it was probably Lily of the Valley, tissue paper. And inside the tissue paper, I slowly unwrapped it, was a gold and green British Railways totem badge. Mm. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, that's a cap badge worn by senior railway staff. And it was like being sent a piece of treasure. Mm. So that was what got me interested in trains. And a couple of years later, I joined the Isle of Wight Steam Railway as a volunteer and worked there winter on the tracks, on the building, summer with the visitors. And I did that probably for 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
What I noticed was actually that the trains were wonderful, but I was more interested in the buildings, the platforms, the signs, maybe even the station gardens. It was something about the sense of place, the special places that railway stations can be. Mm. That's what got me interested in the architecture and design of the trains and stations, probably more than the trains themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I share you that, because when I tell people I like trains, the first thing they say is, "Oh, you're a train spotter." And I'm thinking, well, I'm not really. I don't really know much different between what engine is which. I just love the environment around it. But when you left school, I believe you got a job, am I right in saying this, in the fabric industry as a sample cutter? Can you tell us what that was, please, David?
Yes, well, I was unemployed for years because the only thing I was interested in doing was looking at railway stations. And, well, I didn't know there was a job doing that at the time. And a friend said that there was a job going with her working in the West End of London for a company that made clothes for Marks and Spencer's. And the sample cutters are the people who get the paper patterns from the designers, as it was in the mid-1980s. And they cut around the paper patterns in fabric or material that's been chosen by the designers. And then the cut-out pieces of fabric are given to sewing machinists who then make up the sample garments. And a rail of our sample garments would be taken into Marks & Spencer's headquarters every couple of months. and there would be conversations about the fabrics, the design, sales deals would be made, and hopefully our sales team would come back with the samples and with an order to make 1,200 or 10,000 pairs of jeans or blouses or shirts, mm-hmm. something like that. So my job was really the beginning of the garment moving from two dimensions on the page in a designer sketchbook to being a real thing.
Wow, that's quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was with that company for quite a while, and they realized that I was too good just to be cutting out fabric. So I had other skills too. So I got moved to the office, which calculated how much it would cost to make those garments. And that's partly literally measuring the paper patterns to mm-hmm. think of how much sewing needs to be done. And it's partly estimating how much fabric is needed, how many buttons, how many zips, all the rest of it. And we would put together the total costing for a dozen garments, and that would create the price that the sales team took to Marks and Spencer's and the basis of the order. And that went on until 1994, mm-hmm. so a couple of really good firms. And in the meantime, I'd been doing evening classes in art and design. And I'd got interested in the London Underground as a family of stations. Living in London or commuting to London, I realised that there were 250-odd stations, which some of them belonged to particular families of architects. Some of them look quite different from other ones. So I began to write a book which tried to illustrate with photographs and drawings the history of those underground stations. And the evening classes helped me learn more about the architecture itself and about drawing. And gradually, so by about 1990, I was doing some historical research work for London Underground mm-hmm. and advising them on design. When I say advising on design, talking about things like colour schemes, the history of the architecture of a particular line, which might help the architects think about new design work. And gradually building up this book of the different phases of design of London Underground stations from the 1850s right through to the early 1990s. And then that really got rounded off by doing some research work, quite informal supporting research work for what became the extension of the Jubilee line mm-hmm. to start to develop London Docklands. That now, of course, is itself almost 30 years old and itself is a heritage line, mm-hmm. even though when I was doing this work, it was super modern.
With an abandoned station as well at Charing Cross.
Yes, the secret station, which of course is very exciting for nerdy people who want to hang around in secret stations. And of course, it's used a lot for filming.
Just now you were talking about this book you were working on, Underground Architecture. I bet you didn't realise this at the time, but it has proved to be quite a seminal work. It certainly hugely impressed me. Tell us a bit more about the process of putting that together briefly, please, David.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. I think the way I did it was to have no social life at all for about 5 years. So I was working, then I was commuting home. I'd make myself do 2 hours drawing twice a week. And then I was writing the book by hand, paper and pen on the train, commuting. I met lots of fantastic retired architects. I looked at archives. I looked at historic drawings. I visited all the stations as they were at the time, not in any quick rush, but I went and photographed them, tracked down historic manufacturers of special bricks, special tiles, and just gradually immersed myself in the whole subject of stations on the London Underground, really, just to get to know them literally inside and out.
Wow, that really is a lesson for anyone listening on how to do a book properly. Today we're talking with historian and lecturer David Lawrence, but I'm going to ask you what might sound like a strange question. Do you spend much time in holiday camps?
A very good question. Well, I spent time in caravan parks at Shanklin and Sandown mm-hmm. when I was a kid. And I've actually spent a lot of time in Atherfield Bay Holiday Camp, but only since it closed. You probably know about these urban explorer people who go into old places. I thought that it might be interesting to write a book about holiday camps, so I've probably given up on that idea. But holiday camps are fascinating places in that they were the first opportunity for ordinary folks to go on holiday together and have a couple of weeks in the sun, or at least the British weather, have a good time, not worry about everything, and be fully looked after. I discovered holiday camps because there are these amazing postcards of Butlin's holiday camps from the 1950s and 60s, super technicolor pictures of people dancing, drinking, playing in the fun fairs. And so that got me interested in holiday camps. So I missed myself the big era of visiting these places, but I like to think that I've caught up with them a little bit by visiting them after they've closed and maybe trying to understand a bit more about them.
Oh, nice. Well, I do remember them myself because I don't know if I'm the same age as you or maybe even a bit older, but we got taken to Pontins.
Very nice.
Wick Ferry, I think, was one. Camber Sands was another one. And there was also a caravan park up on the East Coast. I think it was called Holly Marine.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of them. And that was the first place, I think I was about 12 years old or something. It was the first place I heard proper disco music because I went into this club type place. And I think they were playing daft stuff like Kung Fu Fighting and all that kind of early 70s disco stuff. And that got me hooked on electronic music. So, yeah, thanks to holiday camps for that.
Absolutely. And of course, holiday camps are now the venues for fantastic dance weekenders and festivals.
Oh, yes, it's all come full circle.
So they've gone full circle. I can remember when the rave scene went legal in the early 1990s, they were booking places like Hemsby for weekenders, which were fantastic.
Lovely. There's another somewhat oddly British space that you took a bit of a fancy to, the motorway service station.
Indeed. Well, having gone through the whole railway thing, which got me into studying architecture, so I did 5 years as an architecture student, but then I realised that maybe I didn't want to be an architect. There were already plenty out there, and there were a lot of buildings which I was very pleased not to have designed, which I thought rather unpleasant. And I was more interested in the history, and I suppose tube stations, London Underground stations, holiday camps, railway stations. I was thinking about places where people, design, and movement come together. And I was really interested in petrol stations, mostly because you see them by the side of the road, of course. They're brightly lit. They have very clear colours, signs, branding. And they fascinated me. And I knew somebody who worked for a government department that was involved in protecting older buildings and unusual building types, English heritage. And I said to this friend, I'd quite like to research petrol stations because they're really interesting and I'd be very happy to do them for you, English heritage. And my friend said, well, that's a great idea, but unfortunately, it's such a great idea, someone's already had it. So no, you can't do petrol stations. But David, would you like to travel the country visiting motorway service stations? And I thought, well, I don't know if I've ever been to a motorway service station because our family didn't have a car, really. And as you will have gathered from this interview already, I went to most places by train. But I thought about it and they said that they would arrange my accommodation. And what I had to do was visit every service station in the country. This is in the late 1990s. Stay at a lot of service stations. So anyone who's stayed at a travel lodge will know what I'm talking about. Take photographs of the service stations and write some kind of notes, thinking about whether one of them was special enough to be listed. In other words, protected from being demolished or redeveloped. So in 1999 to 2000, I travelled around Britain for about 6 months and lived frequently at motorway service stations. I even spent, and this is seasonal, I spent one Christmas at Washington Berkeley services, which were on the A1M just south of Newcastle. And I have to say, it was quite unusual, but fascinating to be in one of these large catering buildings and hotels at the side of the road, seeing the whole of Britain on the way to another part of Britain to visit people for Christmas. So absolutely fascinating. I wouldn't want to do it too often, but it was fascinating for that time. Of course, there are service stations in Europe and the United States, and the early English service stations, motorway service areas, were copied from America, Italy, and Germany. Mm-hmm. My research time was mostly focused on England because I had a relatively short amount of time to visit these places. I have stopped at lots of service stations in Eastern Germany, which are fantastic. Most of them are still styled from the 1970s. The food, I'm pleased to say, is somewhat fresher. And just thinking about the French ones, what a lot of service stations do is they have devices which put an aroma into the air.
Oh.
So we might be smelling freshly baked baguettes or freshly baked croissants or freshly baked cinnamon buns, for example, but it's not beyond the skills of contemporary engineers to enhance those aromas so that they actually smell better than the real thing. But that adds to the excitement, because I think when you stop at a service station place, they're quite unreal anyway. They are somewhere that we stop for 30 minutes or an hour after we've been driving at high speed for several hours. So they're surreal, but that's part of what I think makes them fascinating. And that was what really inspired me to put together a couple of books about service stations, because I thought if they interest me, they'll interest other people. Again, I discovered that service stations used to sell postcards. People would buy a postcard from Rownham's, let's say, outside Southampton, or Winchester, or Newport Pagnell, or Watford Gap. And they would send that postcard with a message about the service station to a friend somewhere else. And these postcards were beautiful, brightly coloured scenes of these really weird places. And that got me thinking that it would make a really good subject for a book. So, as you know, Mark, there was a book on motorway services called Food on the Move, which I put together really as a side job when I was already working at the university. And I suppose what I tried to do with that book, as with other books, is I knew there were lots of interesting things about the services, and I knew that most people wouldn't spend very much time at the services. So the book tries to be an informative and entertaining gallery or exhibition or maybe even a museum of motorway services, so that people don't have to go to them to be able to get a sense of what it's like to be at one. And motorway services, they're important commercial operations. They don't keep things. They don't keep records. They don't really keep archives. A lot was thrown away. So part of the joy of putting together the book on motorway services, Food on the Move, was to collect things like sugar packets, joining the Sugar Packet Collectors Club, finding different kinds of cutlery branded with service station locations, finding these postcards, interviewing people that worked in service stations, and trying to just gather together that strange, fascinating, quite sealed world of service stations for the motorists, and also the life behind the scenes.
I think you've done an absolutely fascinating job there, because it's that part of society that's almost forgotten, it's almost throwaway, and yet when you draw people's attention to it, they've all got a little story about it.
Absolutely. The service station I stayed at one Christmas, Washington Birtley, when it opened, it was launched by a leading petrol brand, but it was designed as what they call a taverna. Now, I have not seen anything less like a taverna than this big brick catering building at Washington Birtley. But the local newspapers reported it as being like something out of Star Trek. A lot of the catering was done by automatic machine, and this is 1967, so it's pretty special at the time. And all the waitresses their uniforms were styled like air hostess uniforms.
Oh.
And they were trained in first aid, and some of them even knew the emergency measures needed if someone was turned up and was having a baby
mm-hmm.
on the motorway.
Wow.
So these were highly skilled people, and the place was a total sensation.
Yeah, definitely one of those particularly strange places, often ignored. Now, I'm going to pull you back a bit now to your career having returned to academic studies. I think it was around about 1998, wasn't it, I believe?
Yes, well, the book on the underground got me into a university to study architecture, and the first part of that was 2 years, and then there was a year of practical working, and then another 2 years study, which took me through about 5 years. I was at Kingston University and then the University of Westminster. I worked on various research projects there. There's a fantastic architectural practice from the 1960s and 70s called Archigram, who did lots of really interesting visionary architecture in drawings. They didn't get much built, but they did do the drawings. And interestingly, they designed a railway station, a holiday camp, and a motorway service station.
No way. So, that's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. And we worked on exhibitions for them and put together an archive. And that was really good. And I eventually found my way to Kingston University, where I began to teach architecture part-time and then spend a bit more time doing that. I also taught students the history of architecture. So how did it begin? Particular eras of interesting buildings, which, of course, somehow picked up the earlier amateur work that I'd done looking at different phases of tube station design. Taught at Kingston, kept teaching at Kingston, and 27 years later, I'm still teaching at Kingston and still teaching students about the historic buildings and the conservation of historic buildings. So in a way, the career has been lots of bits and pieces that have somehow gradually made sense over time and come together and mean that I can still be interested in those subjects, but most importantly, make a contribution to people who are starting out in their careers as I was 30 odd years ago.
Well, it's good to know that people like you are helping to enthuse young people in understanding something as important as the design and the architecture that you cover. So you've told us about a couple of your books, David, but can you talk us through another of my favourites of your books, A Logo for London? How important to our capital is this sort of icon of transport identity?
Well, there's a word for it, which I can't think of at the moment because it's a long word, but there are cities like the Big Apple, and we know that's New York. London, it's the London Underground, London Transport, Transport for London symbol, which we call a roundel or a bullseye or a target.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I became fascinated because I was commuting in London, I was traveling around in London at the weekends, and I saw this symbol everywhere. But I saw it in many, many different versions. Direction signs, different colours, different sizes, station name signs, of course, on tube trains with the map. And I thought someone must have written about this. And weirdly, someone hadn't written about it. So I set myself the task of doing it. And we did a book in 2000, I think, which was quite handy for the millennium. And then someone said, well, it's a great book, but could you do another one? Just the same, but bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote another one, which I think came out around 2008, 2010. So it is essential to London, the capital, as an icon. And I think now we've gone through so many developments on the London railway system. We've got the Overground, we've got the Elizabeth Line. We are totally an international city. That symbol is what tells people from all over the world that they're in London.
Yeah. There is a logo, I hope, that is not going away. Can you talk to us about another of your excellent books, Bright Underground Spaces, and why you were so taken with the architect, which the book's all about, Charles Holden?
Well, I'd done this first book called Underground Architecture in 1994, and that was deliberately a selection of different historical phases of building. And I realised that Charles Holden had done more for the London Underground than any other architect. And Holden and his team of assistants had done a lot of work in a very short period of time, from around about 1925 to probably 1938. Mm-hmm. Huge amount of work, drawing inspiration from Europe, particularly Germany and the Netherlands, Holland, and also a bit from the United States. I'd also discovered that there was an archive of lots of drawings from Charles Holden's architectural team. And so it made sense to pull all that material together and really celebrate these classic 1930s modern tube stations in London.
Mm-hmm. And they are really sort of quintessential London, aren't they, really? What kind of effect do you think work like his and his company had on architectural styles outside the capital?
Interestingly, the effect was limited because they cost a lot of money to develop. One station, relatively speaking, would be very expensive. And what the Underground was doing was pouring millions in 1930s money, probably billions now, into building very similar stations along a new line with totally coherent, consistent branding, no expense spared. And the towns outside London just did not have that money. So if there are influences, and I think it's a really good question to ask, there are areas of Britain around Manchester, around Liverpool, maybe a bit around the northeast, where the transport companies and their architects did work to make similar kinds of progressive, modern, passenger-friendly buildings, but nowhere near on the scale of London.
Yeah. Now, you produced a couple of other books, which I'm really fond of, particularly on British railway design. And now, can you talk us through what a massive job that must have been?
Yes. Well, again, I was asked to update a book called A Journey by Design. And it was a book which I'd had for years and I was a great admirer of. But the more I looked at updating it, I realized that if I just updated it, I would spoil the original book. I would probably make a mess of it. And also, there was so much that could be included, which hadn't been really discussed in this original book, that it was better to start from the beginning. And again, we come back to a point I made earlier, which is the social life has to be put to one side, really. So I began to explore every aspect of British Rail, from the designs and colours of the trains, right through to the design of the branding, the leaflets, the publicity, the posters, the station architecture. And I tried to make a story out of it, I suppose, to understand how British Rail had gone from being something very much in the steam age, relying on the beauty of steam locomotives and carriages and 19th century architecture, to something that was super modern, that was styled by design practices rather than engineers, and tried to show how the network had stayed a useful network but had evolved from something very engineering based through to something that was very much looking to airline design and wanted to be of a global standard in the way that it provided buildings and trains for people in Britain.
And you've developed some of those themes, I believe, in your most recent book, which covers an aspect of train travel that perhaps passengers don't always notice, but without them, they would be sort of standing in the cold.
Absolutely. I was asked to write a book about platforms, the things that we stand on when we're waiting for a train. And I thought that that was probably on its own a little bit of a limited subject, which wouldn't be much help to people. And it would be a very short book because platforms are mostly a bit of brick, a bit of concrete, a bit of earth, and we stand on them. And that's it. So I suggested that we also think about the buildings, the kiosks on top of those platforms. And that produced the title Platforms and Pavilions. Mm-hmm. and it provided the opportunity to talk about the architecture of the stations, the colours of the stations, the designs of things like the canopies over the passengers. There was a real fashion in the Victorian Edwardian periods to have very patterned woodwork designs. I could look at the signs. I even thought about station gardens and quite obscure subjects like the dogs that used to work on station platforms collecting money for railway charities.
Wow.
So I think it's been designed as quite an eclectic book, but what it does is fill in lots of gaps in the history of the railway and the railway stations, which hadn't been covered by anybody else.
Mm-hmm. So it's probably true to say that most of your career really has been telling a story and sharing the joy of new knowledge with audiences in a very kind of visually rich and accessible way. But I believe you also have a bit of a secret pirate past, David. Do tell.
Ah, well, in the early 1970s, I became very interested in pirate radio. It was the only good place to hear soul music, funk music, and even early punk music, which was not played on the BBC at all. We're talking about a time when there were radio stations like Capital, which were just starting, which played fantastic music, but again, not too much specialist. I think we probably only had John Peel actually doing punk music.
Mm.
And I got interested in collecting records, playing them. And as with all the things that I do, I suppose it was about finding something that I was excited by and then finding the audience. That was the important thing. And working on the Isle of Wight Steam Railway, I got to know a couple of other blokes about my age who were very interested in transmitters and in pirate radio. So we recorded tapes at home, probably using one turntable and a cassette recorder, and we put together a 60 or 90 minute cassette. And then we would find a high point on the island, rig up the transmitter and the aerial, and play the cassettes. We had an audience, Portsmouth, Southampton, probably not much further than that. But we did that for a while, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Wow. What was that called at the time then, David?
That was Free Island Radio. We even did a live night at a hotel on Ryde Esplanade.
Wow.
Which was great fun. So we met all the Isle of Wight punks as they were in 1977-78.
It's been so interesting to talk with a fellow railway enthusiast, writer, lecturer and broadcaster. I do hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I have. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You can find Dave Lawrence's books on railway clocks and stations, the tube, motorway services, British rail design, and even London transport cap badges, and of course his most recent release, Platforms and Pavilions, at your usual search engine or your local bookshop. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We'll be doing more chatting art, transport, communications history. Please do join us then.